rejects reality, rejects existence. And the feelings that move him from then on are hatred for all the values of man's life, and lust for all the evils that destroy it. A mystic relishes the spectacle of suffering, of poverty, subservience, and terror. These give him a feeling of triumph, a proof of the defeat of rational reality. But no other reality exists. No matter whose welfare he professes to serve, be it the welfare of God or of that disembodied gargoyle he describes as the people, no matter what ideal he proclaims in terms of some supernatural dimension, in fact, in reality, on earth, his ideal is death. His craving is to kill. His only satisfaction is to torture. Destruction is the only end that the mystic's creed has ever achieved, as it is the only end that you see them achieving today. And if the ravages wrought by their act have not made them question their doctrines, if they profess to be moved by love, yet are not deterred by piles of human corpses, it is because the truth about their souls is worse than the obscene excuse you have allowed them, the excuse that the end justifies the means, and that the horrors they practice are means to nobler ends. The truth is that those horrors are their ends. You who were depraved enough to believe that you could adjust yourself to a mystic's dictatorship and could please him by obeying his orders, there is no way to please him. When you obey, he will reverse his orders. He seeks obedience for the sake of obedience and destruction for the sake of destruction. You who are craven enough to believe that you can make terms with a mystic by giving in to his extortions, there is no way to buy him off. The bribe he wants is your life, as slowly or as fast as you were willing to give it in. And the monster he seeks to bribe is the hidden blank out in his mind, which drives him to kill in order not to learn that the death he desires is his own. You who are innocent enough to believe that the forces let loose in your world today are moved by greed for material plunder? The mystic's scramble for spoils is only a screen to conceal from their mind the nature of their motive. Wealth is a means of human life, and they clamor for wealth in imitation of living beings, to pretend to themselves that they desire to live. But their swinish indulgence in plundered luxury is not enjoyment, it is escape. They do not want to own your fortune, they want you to lose it. They do not want to succeed, they want you to fail. They do not want to live, they want you to die. They desire nothing, they hate existence, and they keep running, each trying not to learn that the object of his hatred is himself. You who've never grasped the nature of evil, you who describe them as misguided idealists, may the God you invented forgive you. They are the essence of evil. They, those anti-living objects who seek by devouring the world to fill the selfless zero of their soul. It is not your wealth that they're after. Theirs is a conspiracy against the mind, which means against life and man. It is a conspiracy without leader or direction, and the random little thugs of the moment who cash in on the agony of one land or another are chance scum riding the torrent from the broken dam of the sewer of centuries, from the reservoir of hatred for reason, for logic, for ability, for achievement, for joy, stored by every whining anti-human who ever preached the superiority of the heart over the mind. It is a conspiracy of all those who seek not to live, but to get away with living. Those who seek to cut just one small corner of reality and are drawn, by feeling, to all the others who are busy cutting other corners. A conspiracy that unites by links of evasion all those who pursue a zero as a value. The professor who, unable to think, takes pleasure in crippling the mind of his students. The businessman who, to protect his stagnation, takes pleasure in chaining the ability of competitors. The neurotic who, to defend his self-loathing, takes pleasure in breaking men of self-esteem. The incompetent who takes pleasure in defeating achievement. The mediocrity who takes pleasure in demolishing greatness. The eunuch who takes pleasure in the castration of all pleasure. and all their intellectual munition-makers, all those who preach that the immolation of virtue will transform vices into virtue. Death is the premise at the root of their theories. Death is the goal of their actions in practice, and you are the last of their victims. We, who were the living buffers between you and the nature of your creed, are no longer there to save you from the effects of your chosen beliefs. We are no longer willing to pay with our lives the debts you incurred in yours, or the moral deficit piled up by all the generations behind you. You had been living on borrowed time, and I am the man who has called in the loan. I am the man whose existence your blankouts were intended to permit you to ignore. I am the man whom you did not want either to live or to die. You did not want me to live because you were afraid of knowing that I carried the responsibility you dropped and that your lives depended upon me. You did not want me to die because you knew it. 12 years ago, when I worked in your world, I was an inventor. I was one of a profession that came last in human history and will be first to vanish on the way back to the subhuman. An inventor is a man who asks why of the universe and lets nothing stand between the answer and his mind. Like the man who discovered the use of steam or the man who discovered the use of oil, I discovered a source of energy which was available since the birth of the globe, but which men had not known how to use except as an object of worship, of terror, and of legends about a thundering god. I completed the experimental model of a motor that would have made a fortune for me and for those who had hired me, a motor that would have raised the efficiency of every human installation using power and would have added the gift of higher productivity to every hour you spend at earning your living. Then one night at a factory meeting, I heard myself sentenced to death by reason of my achievement. I heard 3 parasites assert that my brain and my life were their property, that my right to exist was conditional and depended on the satisfaction of their desires. The purpose of my ability, they said, was to serve the needs of those who were less able. I had no right to live, they said, by reason of my competence for living. Their right to live was unconditional, by reason of their incompetence. Then I saw what was wrong with the world. I saw what destroyed men and nations, and where the battle for life had to be fought. I saw that the enemy was an inverted morality, and that my sanction was its only power. I saw that evil was impotent, that evil was the irrational, the blind, the anti-real, and that the only weapon of its triumph was the willingness of the good to serve it. Just as the parasites around me were proclaiming their helpless dependence on my mind and were expecting me voluntarily to accept a slavery they had no power to enforce, just as they were counting on my self-immolation to provide them with the means of their plan, so throughout the world and throughout men's history, in every version and form, from the extortions of loafing relatives to the atrocities of collectivized countries, it is the good, the able, the men of reason, who act as their own destroyers, who transfuse to evil the blood of their virtue and let evil transmit to them the poison of destruction, thus gaining for evil the power of survival and for their own values the impotence of death. I saw that there comes a point in the defeat of any man of virtue when his own consent is needed for evil to win, and that no manner of injury done to him by others can succeed if he chooses to withhold his consent. I saw that I could put an end to your outrages by pronouncing a single word in my mind. I pronounced it. The word was no. I quit that factory. I quit your world. I made it my job to warn your victims and to give them the method and the weapon to fight you. The method was to refuse to deflect retribution. The weapon was justice. If you want to know what you lost when I quit and when my strikers deserted your world, Stand on an empty stretch of soil in a wilderness unexplored by men, and ask yourself what manner of survival you would achieve and how long you would last if you refused to think, with no one around to teach you the motions, or, if you chose to think, how much your mind would be able to discover. Ask yourself how many independent conclusions you have reached in the course of your life, and how much of your time was spent on performing the actions you learned from others. Ask yourself whether you would be able to discover how to till the soil and grow your food, whether you would be able to invent a wheel, a lever, an induction coil, a generator, an electronic tube. Then decide whether men of ability are exploiters who live by the fruit of your labor and rob you of the wealth that you produce, and whether you dare to believe that you possess the power to enslave them. Let your women take a look at a jungle female with her shriveled face and pendulous breasts, as she sits grinding meal in a bowl, hour after hour, century by century. Then let them ask themselves whether their instinct of tool-making will provide them with their electric refrigerators, their washing machines and vacuum cleaners, and, if not, whether they care to destroy those who provided it all, but not by instinct. Take a look around you, you savages who stutter that ideas are created by men's means of production, that a machine is not the product of human thought, but a mystical power that produces human thinking. You have never discovered the industrial age, and you cling to the morality of the barbarian eras when a miserable form of human subsistence was produced by the muscular labor of slaves. Every mystic had always longed for slaves, to protect him from the material reality he dreaded. But you grotesque little atavists, stare blindly at the skyscrapers and smokestacks around you, and dream of enslaving the material providers who were scientists, inventors, industrialists. When you clamor for public ownership of the means of production, you are clamoring for public ownership of the mind. I have taught my strikers that the answer you deserve is only, try and get it. You proclaim yourself unable to harness the forces of inanimate matter, yet propose to harness the minds of men who were able to achieve the feats you cannot equal. You proclaim that you cannot survive without us, yet propose to dictate the terms of our survival. You proclaim that you need us, yet indulge the impertinence of asserting your right to rule us by force, and expect that we, who are not afraid of that physical nature which fills you with terror, will cower at the sight of any lout who has talked you into voting him a chance to command us. You propose to establish a social order based on the following tenets: that you're incompetent to run your own life, but competent to run the lives of others; that you're unfit to exist in freedom, but fit to become an omnipotent ruler; that you're unable to earn your living by the use of your own intelligence, but able to judge politicians and to vote them into jobs of total power over arts you have never seen, over sciences you have never studied, over achievements of which you have no knowledge, over the gigantic industries where you, by your own definition of your capacity, would be unable successfully to fill the job of assistant greaser. This idol of your cult of zero worship, this symbol of impotence, the congenital dependent, is your image of man and your standard of value, in whose likeness you strive to refashion your soul. It's only human, you cry in defense of any depravity, reaching the stage of self-abasement when you seek to make the concept human mean the weakling, the fool, the rotter, the liar, the failure, the coward, the fraud, and to exile from the human race the hero, the thinker, the producer, the inventor, the strong, the purposeful, the pure. As if to feel were human, but to think were not. As if to fail were human, but to succeed were not. As if corruption were human, but virtue were not. As if the premise of death were proper to man, but the premise of life were not. In order to deprive us of honor, that you may then deprive us of our wealth, you have always regarded us as slaves who deserve no moral recognition. You praise any venture that claims to be non-profit, and damn the men who made the profits that make the venture possible. You regard as in the public interest any project serving those who do not pay. It is not in the public interest to provide any services for those who do the paying. Public benefit is anything given as alms. To engage in trade is to injure the public. Public welfare is the welfare of those who do not earn it. Those who do are entitled to no welfare. The public, to you, is whoever has failed to achieve any virtue or value. Whoever achieves it, whoever provides the goods you require for survival, ceases to be regarded as part of the public or as part of the human race. What blank out permitted you to hope that you could get away with this muck of contradictions and to plan it as an ideal society when the no of your victims was sufficient to demolish the whole of your structure? What permits any insolent beggar to wave his sores in the face of his betters and to plead for help in the tone of a threat? You cry, as he does, that you were counting on our pity, but your secret hope is the moral code that has taught you to count on our guilt. You expect us to feel guilty of our virtues in the presence of your vices, wounds, and failures, guilty of succeeding at existence, guilty of enjoying the life that you damn, yet beg us to help you to live. Did you want to know who is John Galt? I am the first man of ability who refused to regard it as guilt. I am the first man who would not do penance for my virtues or let them be used as the tools of my destruction. I am the first man who would not suffer martyrdom at the hands of those who wished me to perish for the privilege of keeping them alive. I am the first man who told them that I did not need them. And until they learned to deal with me as traitors, giving value for value, they would have to exist without me, as I would exist without them. Then I would let them learn whose is the need and whose the ability. And if human survival is the standard, whose terms would set the way to survive? I have done by plan and intention what had been done throughout history by silent default. There have always been men of intelligence who went on strike, in protest and despair, but they did not know the meaning of their action. The man who retires from public life to think, but not to share his thoughts. The man who chooses to spend his years in the obscurity of menial employment, keeping to himself the fire of his mind, never giving it form, expression, or reality, refusing to bring it into a world he despises. The man who is defeated by revulsion. The man who renounces before he is started, the man who gives up rather than give in, the man who functions at a fraction of his capacity, disarmed by his longing for an ideal he has not found. They are on strike against unreason, on strike against your world and your values. But not knowing any values of their own, they abandon the quest to know. In the darkness of their hopeless indignation, which is righteous without knowledge of the right, and passionate without knowledge of desire, they concede to you the power of reality and surrender the incentives of their mind. And they perish in bitter futility, as rebels who never learned the object of their rebellion, as lovers who never discovered their love. The infamous times you call the Dark Ages were an era of intelligence on strike, when men of ability went underground and lived undiscovered, studying in secret, and died, destroying the works of their mind, when only a few of the bravest of martyrs remained to keep the human race alive. Every period ruled by mystics was an era of stagnation and want, when most men were on strike against existence, working for less than their barest survival, leaving nothing but scraps for their rulers to loot, refusing to think, to venture, to produce, when the ultimate collector of their profits and the final authority on truth or error was the whim of some gilded degenerate sanctioned as superior to reason by divine right and by grace of a club. The road of human history was a string of blankouts over sterile stretches eroded by faith and force, with only a few brief bursts of sunlight, when the released energy of the men of the mind performed the wonders you gaped at, admired, and promptly extinguished again. but there will be no extinction this time. The game of the mystics is up. You will perish in and by your own unreality. We, the men of reason, will survive. I have called out on strike the kind of martyrs who had never deserted you before. I have given them the weapon they had lacked, the knowledge of their own moral value. I have taught them that the world is ours whenever we choose to claim it, by virtue and grace of the fact that ours is the morality of life. They, the great victims who had produced all the wonders of humanity's brief summer, they, the industrialists, the conquerors of matter, had not discovered the nature of their right. They had known that theirs was the power. I taught them that theirs was the glory. You, who dare to regard us as the moral inferiors of any mystic who claims supernatural visions, you who scramble like vultures for plundered pennies, yet honor a fortune-teller above a fortune-maker, you who scorn a businessman as ignoble, but esteem any posturing artist as exalted, the root of your standards is that mystic miasma which comes from primordial swamps, that cult of death which pronounces a businessman immoral by reason of the fact that he keeps you alive. You who claim that you long to rise above the crude concerns of the body, above the drudgery of serving mere physical needs. Who is enslaved by physical needs? The Hindu who labors from sunrise to sunset at the shafts of a hand plow for a bowl of rice, or the American who is driving a tractor? Who is the conqueror of physical reality? The man who sleeps on a bed of nails, or the man who sleeps on an inner spring mattress? Which is the monument to the triumph of the human spirit over matter? The germ-eaten hovels on the shorelines of the Ganges, or the Atlantic skyline of New York? Unless you learn the answers to these questions, and learn to stand at reverent attention when you face the achievements of man's mind, you will not stay much longer on this earth, which we love and will not permit you to damn. You will not sneak by with the rest of your lifespan. I have foreshortened the usual course of history, and have let you discover the nature of the payment you had hoped to switch to the shoulders of others. It is the last of your own living power that will now be drained to provide the unearned for the worshippers and carriers of death. Do not pretend that a malevolent reality defeated you. You were defeated by your own evasions. Do not pretend that you will perish for a noble ideal. You will perish as fodder for the haters of man. But to those of you who still retain a remnant of the dignity and will to love one's life, I am offering the chance to make a choice. Choose whether you wish to perish for a morality you have never believed or practiced. Pause on the brink of self-destruction and examine your values and your life. You had known how to take an inventory of your wealth. Now take an inventory of your mind. Since childhood, you have been hiding the guilty secret that you feel no desire to be moral, no desire to seek self-immolation, that you dread and hate your code, but dare not say it even to yourself, that you're devoid of those moral instincts which others profess to feel. The less you felt, the louder you proclaimed your selfless love and servitude to others, in dread of ever letting them discover your own self, the self that you betrayed, the self that you kept in concealment, like a skeleton in the closet of your body. And they, who were at once your dupes and your deceivers, they listened and voiced their loud approval, in dread of ever letting you discover that they were harboring the same unspoken secret. Existence among you is a giant pretense, an act you all perform for one another, each feeling that he is the only guilty freak, each placing his moral authority in the unknowable known only to others, each faking the reality he feels they expect him to fake, none having the courage to break the vicious circle. No matter what dishonorable compromise you've made with your impracticable creed, no matter what miserable balance, half-cynicism, half-superstition you now manage to maintain, you still preserve the root, the lethal tenet, the belief that the moral and the practical are opposites. Since childhood, you have been running from the terror of a choice you have never dared fully to identify. If the practical, whatever you must practice to exist, whatever works, succeeds, achieves your purpose, whatever brings you food and joy, whatever profits you, is evil. And if the good, the moral, is the impractical, whatever fails, destroys, frustrates, whatever injures you and brings you loss or pain, then your choice is to be moral or to live. The sole result of that murderous doctrine was to remove morality from life. You grew up to believe that moral laws bear no relation to the job of living, except as an impediment and threat, that man's existence is an amoral jungle where anything goes and anything works. And in that fog of switching definitions which descends upon a frozen mind, you have forgotten that the evils damned by your creed were the virtues required for living, and you have come to believe that actual evils are the practical means of existence. Forgetting that the impractical good was self-sacrifice, you believe that self-esteem is impractical. Forgetting that the practical evil was production, you believe that robbery is practical. Swinging like a helpless branch in the wind of an uncharted moral wilderness, you dare not fully to be evil or fully to live. When you are honest, you feel the resentment of a sucker. When you cheat, you feel terror and shame. When you are happy, your joy is diluted by guilt. When you suffer, your pain is augmented by the feeling that pain is your natural state. You pity the men you admire. You believe they are doomed to fail. You envy the man you hate. You believe they are the masters of existence. You feel disarmed when you come up against a scoundrel. You believe that evil is bound to win, since the moral is the impotent, the impractical. Morality, to you, is a phantom scarecrow made of duty, of boredom, of punishment, of pain. A crossbreed between the first schoolteacher of your past and the tax collector of your present. A scarecrow standing in a barren field, waving a stick to chase away your pleasures. And pleasure to you is a liquor-soggy brain, a mindless slut, the stupor of a moron who stakes his cash on some animal's race, since pleasure cannot be moral. If you identify your actual belief, you will find a triple damnation. Of yourself, of life, of virtue, in the grotesque conclusion you have reached. You believe that morality is a necessary evil. Do you wonder why you live without dignity, love without fire, and die without resistance? Do you wonder why, wherever you look, you see nothing but unanswerable questions? Why your life is torn by impossible conflicts? Why you spend it straddling irrational fences to evade artificial choices, such as soul or body, mind or heart, security or freedom, private profit or public good? Do you cry that you find no answers? By what means did you hope to find them? You reject your tool of perception, your mind, then complain that the universe is a mystery. You discard your key, then wail that all doors are locked against you. You start out in pursuit of the irrational, then damn existence for making no sense. The fence you have been straddling for 2 hours, while hearing my words and seeking to escape them, is the coward's formula contained in the sentence, "But we don't have to go to extremes." The extreme you have always struggled to avoid is the recognition that reality is final. That A is A, and that the truth is true. A moral code impossible to practice, a code that demands imperfection or death, has taught you to dissolve all ideas in fog, to permit no firm definitions, to regard any concept as approximate and any rule of conduct as elastic, to hedge on any principle, to compromise on any value, to take the middle of any road. By extorting your acceptance of supernatural absolutes, it has forced you to reject the absolute of nature. By making moral judgments impossible, it has made you incapable of rational judgment. A code that forbids you to cast the first stone has forbidden you to admit the identity of stones and to know when or if you're being stoned. The man who refuses to judge, who neither agrees nor disagrees, who declares that there are no absolutes and believes that he escapes responsibility, is the man responsible for all the blood that is now spilled in the world. Reality is an absolute. Existence is an absolute. A speck of dust is an absolute, and so is a human life. Whether you live or die is an absolute. Whether you have a piece of bread or not is an absolute. Whether you eat your bread or see it vanish into a looter's stomach is an absolute. There are two sides to every issue. One side is right and the other is wrong, but the middle is always evil. The man who is wrong still retains some respect for truth, if only by accepting the responsibility of choice. But the man in the middle is the knave who blanks out the truth in order to pretend that no choice or values exist, who is willing to sit out the course of any battle, willing to cash in on the blood of the innocent or to crawl on his belly to the guilty, who dispenses justice by condemning both the robber and the robbed to jail, who solves conflicts by ordering the thinker and the fool to meet each other halfway. In any compromise between food and poison, it is only death that can win. In any compromise between good and evil, it is only evil that can profit. In that transfusion of blood which drains the good to feed the evil, the compromiser is the transmitting rubber tube. You, who are half rational, half coward, have been playing a con game with reality, but the victim you have conned is yourself. When men reduce their virtues to the approximate, then evil acquires the force of an absolute. When loyalty to an unyielding purpose is dropped by the virtuous, it's picked up by scoundrels. And you get the indecent spectacle of a cringing, bargaining, traitorous good and a self-righteously uncompromising evil. As you surrendered to the mystics of muscle when they told you that ignorance consists of claiming knowledge, so now you surrender to them when they shriek that immorality consists of pronouncing moral judgment. When they yell that it is selfish to be certain that you were right, you hasten to assure them that you're certain of nothing. When they shout that it's immoral to stand on your convictions, you assure them that you have no convictions whatever. When the thugs of Europe's people's states snarl that you were guilty of intolerance because you don't treat your desire to live and their desire to kill you as a difference of opinion, you cringe and hasten to assure them that you are not intolerant of any horror. When some barefoot bum in some pest hole of Asia yells at you, "How dare you be rich?" you apologize and beg him to be patient and promise him you'll give it all away. You have reached the blind alley of the treason you committed when you agreed that you had no right to exist. Once you believed it was only a compromise, you conceded it was evil to live for yourself, but moral to live for the sake of your children. Then you conceded that it was selfish to live for your children, but moral to live for your community. Then you conceded that it was selfish to live for your community, but moral to live for your country. Now, you are letting this greatest of countries be devoured by any scum from any corner of the earth, while you concede that it is selfish to live for your country and that your moral duty is to live for the globe. A man who has no right to life has no right to values and will not keep them. At the end of your road of successive betrayals, stripped of weapons, of certainty, of honor, you commit your final act of treason and sign your petition of intellectual bankruptcy. While the muscle mystics of the people's states proclaim that they're the champions of reason and science, you agree and hasten to proclaim that faith is your cardinal principle, that reason is on the side of your destroyers, but yours is the side of faith. To the struggling remnants of rational honesty in the twisted, bewildered minds of your children, you declare that you can offer no rational argument to support the ideas that created this country, that there is no rational justification for freedom, for property, for justice, for rights, that they rest on a mystical insight and can be accepted only on faith, that in reason and logic the enemy is right, but faith is superior to reason. You declare to your children that it is rational to loot, to torture, to enslave, to expropriate, to murder, but that they must resist the temptations of logic and stick to the discipline of remaining irrational. that skyscrapers, factories, radios, airplanes were the products of faith and mystic intuition, while famines, concentration camps, and firing squads are the products of a reasonable manner of existence. That the Industrial Revolution was the revolt of the men of faith against that era of reason and logic, which is known as the Middle Ages. Simultaneously, in the same breath, to the same child, you declare that the looters who rule the people's states will surpass this country in material production, since they are the representatives of science, but that it's evil to be concerned with physical wealth, and that one must renounce material prosperity. You declare that the looters' ideals are noble, but they do not mean them, while you do. That your purpose in fighting the looters is only to accomplish their aims, which they cannot accomplish, but you can. And that the way to fight them is to beat them to it and give one's wealth away. Then you wonder why your children join the people's thugs or become half-crazed delinquents. You wonder why the looters' conquests keep creeping closer to your doors. And you blame it on human stupidity, declaring that the masses are impervious to reason. You blank out the open public spectacle of the looters' fight against the mind and the fact that their bloodiest horrors are unleashed to punish the crime of thinking. You blank out the fact that most mystics of muscle started out as mystics of spirit, that they keep switching from one to the other, that the men you call materialists and spiritualists are only two halves of the same dissected human, forever seeking completion, but seeking it by swinging from the destruction of the flesh to the destruction of the soul and vice versa. That they keep running from your colleges to the slave pens of Europe, to an open collapse into the mystic muck of India, seeking any refuge against reality, any form of escape from the mind. You blank it out and cling to your hypocrisy of faith in order to blank out the knowledge that the looters have a stranglehold upon you, which consists of your moral code. That the looters are the final and consistent practitioners of the morality you're half obeying, half evading. That they practice it the only way it can be practiced, by turning the earth into a sacrificial furnace. That your morality forbids you to oppose them in the only way they can be opposed, by refusing to become a sacrificial animal and proudly asserting your right to exist. That in order to fight them to the finish and with full rectitude, it is your morality that you have to reject. You blank it out, because your self-esteem is tied to that mystic unselfishness which you've never possessed or practiced, but spent so many years pretending to possess that the thought of denouncing it fills you with terror. No value is higher than self-esteem, but you've invested it in counterfeit securities, and now your morality has caught you in a trap where you were forced to protect your self-esteem by fighting for the creed of self-destruction. The grim joke is on you. That need of self-esteem, which you're unable to explain or to define, belongs to my morality, not yours. It's the objective token of my code. It is my proof within your own soul. By a feeling he has not learned to identify, but has derived from his first awareness of existence, from his discovery that he has to make choices, man knows that his desperate need of self-esteem is a matter of life or death. As a being of volitional consciousness, he knows that he must know his own value in order to maintain his own life. He knows that he has to be right. To be wrong in action means danger to his life. To be wrong in person, to be evil, means to be unfit for existence. Every act of man's life has to be willed. The mere act of obtaining or eating his food implies that the person he preserves is worthy of being preserved. Every pleasure he seeks to enjoy implies that the person who seeks it is worthy of finding enjoyment. He has no choice about his need of self-esteem. His only choice is the standard by which to gauge it. And he makes his fatal error when he switches this gauge, protecting his life, into the service of his own destruction. When he chooses a standard contradicting existence and sets his self-esteem against reality. Every form of causeless self-doubt, every feeling of inferiority and secret unworthiness is, in fact, man's hidden dread of his inability to deal with existence. But the greater his terror, the more fiercely he clings to the murderous doctrines that choke him. No man can survive the moment of pronouncing himself irredeemably evil. Should he do it, his next moment is insanity or suicide. To escape it, if he's chosen an irrational standard, he will fake, evade, blank out. He will cheat himself of reality, of existence, of happiness, of mind. And he will ultimately cheat himself of self-esteem by struggling to preserve its illusion rather than to risk discovering its lack. To fear to face an issue is to believe that the worst is true. It is not any crime you have ever committed that infects your soul with permanent guilt. It is none of your failures, errors, or flaws, but the blank out by which you attempt to evade them. It is not any sort of original sin or unknown prenatal deficiency, but the knowledge and fact of your basic default, of suspending your mind, of refusing to think. Fear and guilt are your chronic emotions. They are real, and you do deserve them, but they don't come from the superficial reasons you invent to disguise their cause. Not from your selfishness, weakness, or ignorance, but from a real and basic threat to your existence. Fear, because you have abandoned your weapon of survival. Guilt, because you know you have done it volitionally. The self you have betrayed is your mind. Self-esteem is reliance on one's power to think. The ego you seek, that essential you which you cannot express or define, is not your emotions or inarticulate dreams, but your intellect. That judge of your supreme tribunal whom you've impeached in order to drift at the mercy of any stray shyster you describe as your feeling. Then you drag yourself through a self-made night in a desperate quest for a nameless fire, moved by some fading vision of a dawn you had seen and lost. Observe the persistence in mankind's mythologies of the legend about a paradise that men had once possessed. The city of Atlantis, or the Garden of Eden, or some kingdom of perfection, always behind us. The root of that legend exists not in the past of the race, but in the past of every man. You still retain a sense, not as firm as a memory, but diffused, like the pain of hopeless longing, that somewhere in the starting years of your childhood, before you had learned to submit, to absorb the terror of unreason and to doubt the value of your mind, you had known a radiant state of existence. You had known the independence of a rational consciousness facing an open universe. That is the paradise which you have lost, which you seek, which is yours for the taking. Some of you will never know who is John Galt. But those of you who have known a single moment of love for existence and of pride in being its worthy lover, a moment of looking at this earth and letting your glance be its sanction, have known the state of being a man. And I am only the man who knew that that state is not to be betrayed. I am the man who knew what made it possible and who chose consistently to practice and to be what you had practiced and been in that one moment. That choice is yours to make. That choice, the dedication to one's highest potential, is made by accepting the fact that the noblest act you have ever performed is the act of your mind in the process of grasping that 2 and 2 make 4. Whoever you are, you who are alone with my words in this moment, with nothing but your honesty to help you understand, the choice is still open to be a human being. But the price is to start from scratch, to stand naked in the face of reality and reversing a costly historical error to declare, I am, therefore I'll think. Accept the irrevocable fact that your life depends upon your mind. Admit that the whole of your struggle, your doubts, your fakes, your evasions, was a desperate quest for escape from the responsibility of a volitional consciousness. A quest for automatic knowledge, for instinctive action, for intuitive certainty. And while you called it a longing for the state of an angel, what you were seeking was the state of an animal. Accept as your moral ideal the task of becoming a man. Do not say that you're afraid to trust your mind because you know so little. Are you safer in surrendering to mystics and discarding the little that you know? Live and act within the limit of your knowledge and keep expanding it to the limit of your life. Redeem your mind from the hawkshops of authority. Accept the fact that you are not omniscient, but playing a zombie will not give you omniscience. That your mind is fallible, but becoming mindless will not make you infallible. That an error made on your own is safer than 10 truths accepted on faith, because the first leaves you the means to correct it, but the second destroys your capacity to distinguish truth from error. In place of your dream of an omniscient automaton, accept the fact that any knowledge man acquires is acquired by his own will and effort, and that that is his distinction in the universe. That is his nature, his morality, his glory. Discard that unlimited license to evil which consists of claiming that man is imperfect. By what standard do you damn him when you claim it? Accept the fact that in the realm of morality, nothing less than perfection will do. But perfection is not to be gauged by mystic commandments to practice the impossible, and your moral stature is not to be gauged by matters not open to your choice. Man has a single basic choice, to think or not, and that is the gauge of his virtue. Moral perfection is an unbreached rationality, not the degree of your intelligence, but the full and relentless use of your mind, not the extent of your knowledge, but the acceptance of reason as an absolute. Learn to distinguish the difference between errors of knowledge and breaches of morality. An error of knowledge is not a moral flaw, provided you were willing to correct it. Only a mystic would judge human beings by the standard of an impossible automatic omniscience. But a breach of morality is the conscious choice of an action you know to be evil, or a willful evasion of knowledge, a suspension of sight and of thought. That which you do not know is not a moral charge against you, but that which you refuse to know is an account of infamy growing in your soul. Make every allowance for errors of knowledge. Do not forgive or accept any breach of morality. Give the benefit of the doubt to those who seek to know, but treat as potential killers those specimens of insolent depravity who make demands upon you, announcing that they have and seek no reasons, proclaiming as a license that they just feel it. Or those who reject an irrefutable argument by saying it's only logic, which means it's only reality. The only realm opposed to reality is the realm and premise of death. Accept the fact that the achievement of your happiness is the only moral purpose of your life, and that happiness, not pain or mindless self-indulgence, is the proof of your moral integrity, since it is the proof and the result of your loyalty to the achievement of your values. Happiness was the responsibility you dreaded. It required the kind of rational discipline you did not value yourself enough to assume. And the anxious staleness of your days is the monument to your evasion of the knowledge that there is no moral substitute for happiness, that there is no more despicable coward than the man who deserted the battle for his joy, fearing to assert his right to existence, lacking the courage and the loyalty to life of a bird or a flower reaching for the sun. Discard the protective rags of that vice which you called a virtue, humility. Learn to value yourself, which means to fight for your happiness. And when you learn that pride is the sum of all virtues, you will learn to live like a man. As a basic step of self-esteem, learn to treat as the mark of a cannibal any man's demand for your help. To demand it is to claim that your life is his property. And loathsome as such claim might be, there's something still more loathsome: your agreement. Do you ask if it's ever proper to help another man? No. If he claims it as his right, or as a moral duty that you owe him? Yes, if such is your own desire based on your own selfish pleasure in the value of his person and his struggle. Suffering as such is not a value. Only man's fight against suffering is. If you choose to help a man who suffers, do it only on the ground of his virtues, of his fight to recover, of his rational record, or of the fact that he suffers unjustly. Then your action is still a trade, and his virtue is the payment for your help. but to help a man who has no virtues, to help him on the ground of his suffering as such, to accept his faults, his need as a claim, is to accept the mortgage of a zero on your values. A man who has no virtues is a hater of existence, who acts on the premise of death. To help him is to sanction his evil and to support his career of destruction. Be it only a penny you will not miss, or a kindly smile he has not earned. A tribute to a zero is treason to life and to all those who struggle to maintain it. It is of such pennies and smiles that the desolation of your world was made. Do not say that my morality is too hard for you to practice and that you fear it as you fear the unknown. Whatever living moments you have known were lived by the values of my code. But you stifled, negated, betrayed it. You kept sacrificing your virtues to your vices, and the best among men to the worst. Look around you. What you have done to society, you had done it first within your soul. One is the image of the other. This dismal wreckage, which is now your world, is the physical form of the treason you committed to your values, to your friends, to your defenders, to your future, to your country, to yourself. We, whom you are now calling, but who will not answer any longer, we had lived among you, but you failed to know us. You refused to think and to see what we were. You failed to recognize the motor I invented, and it became, in your world, a pile of dead scrap. You failed to recognize the hero in your soul, and you failed to know me when I passed you in the street. When you cried in despair for the unattainable spirit which you felt had deserted your world, you gave it my name, but what you were calling was your own betrayed self-esteem. You will not recover one without the other. When you failed to give recognition to man's mind and attempted to rule human beings by force, those who submitted had no mind to surrender. Those who had were men who don't submit. Thus the man of productive genius assumed in your world the disguise of a playboy and became a destroyer of wealth, choosing to annihilate his fortune rather than surrender it to guns. Thus the thinker, the man of reason, assumed in your world the role of a pirate, to defend his values by force against your force, rather than submit to the rule of brutality. Do you hear me, Francisco d'Anconia and Ragnar Danneskiold, my first friends, my fellow fighters, my fellow outcasts, in whose name and honor I speak? It was the three of us who started what I am now completing. It was the three of us who resolved to avenge this country and to release its imprisoned soul. This greatest of countries was built on my morality, on the inviolate supremacy of man's right to exist. But you dreaded to admit it and live up to it. You stared at an achievement unequaled in history. You looted its effects and blanked out its cause. In the presence of that monument to human morality, which is a factory, a highway, or a bridge, you kept damning this country as immoral and its progress as material greed. You kept offering apologies for this country's greatness to the idol of primordial starvation, to decaying Europe's idol of a leprous, mystic bum. This country, this product of reason, could not survive on the morality of sacrifice. It was not built by men who sought self-immolation or by men who sought handouts. It could not stand on the mystic split that divorced man's soul from his body. It could not live by the mystic doctrine that damned this earth as evil and those who succeeded on earth as depraved. From its start, this country was a threat to the ancient rule of mystics. In the brilliant rocket explosion of its youth, this country displayed to an incredulous world what greatness was possible to man, what happiness was possible on earth. It was one or the other, America or mystics. The mystics knew it. You didn't. You let them infect you with the worship of need, and this country became a giant in body with a mooching midget in place of its soul, while its living soul was driven underground to labor and feed you in silence, unnamed, unhonored, negated, its soul and hero, the industrialist. Do you hear me now, Hank Reardon? The greatest of the victims I have avenged? Neither he nor the rest of us will return until the road is clear to rebuild this country, until the wreckage of the morality of sacrifice has been wiped out of our way. The country's political system is based on its code of morality. We will rebuild America's system on the moral premise which had been its foundation, but which you treated as a guilty underground in your frantic evasion of the conflict between that premise and your mystic morality. The premise that man is an end in himself, not the means to the ends of others. That man's life, his freedom, his happiness are his by inalienable right. You who've lost the concept of a right, you who swing in impotent evasiveness between the claim that rights are a gift of God, a supernatural gift to be taken on faith, or the claim that rights are a gift of society to be broken at its arbitrary whim. The source of man's rights is not divine law or congressional law, but the law of identity. A is A, and man is man. Rights are conditions of existence required by man's nature for his proper survival. If man is to live on earth, it is right for him to use his mind. It is right to act on his own free judgment. It is right to work for his values and to keep the product of his work. If life on earth is his purpose, he has a right to live as a rational being. Nature forbids him the irrational. Any group, any gang, any nation that attempts to negate man's rights is wrong, which means is evil, which means is anti-life. Rights are a moral concept, and morality is a matter of choice. Men are free not to choose man's survival as the standard of their morals and their laws, but not free to escape from the fact that the alternative is a cannibal society, which exists for a while by devouring its best and collapses like a cancerous body, when the healthy have been eaten by the diseased, when the rational have been consumed by the irrational. Such has been the fate of your societies in history, but you've evaded the knowledge of the cause. I am here to state it. The agent of retribution was the law of identity, which you cannot escape. Just as man cannot live by means of the irrational, so too men cannot, or 2,000, or 2 billion. Just as man can't succeed by defying reality, so a nation can't, or a country, or a globe. A is A. The rest is a matter of time, provided by the generosity of victims. Just as man can't exist without his body, so no rights can exist without the right to translate one's rights into reality, to think, to work, and to keep the results, which means the right of property. The modern mystics of muscle who offer you the fraudulent alternative of human rights versus property rights, as if one could exist without the other, are making a last grotesque attempt to revive the doctrine of soul versus body. Only a ghost can exist without material property. Only a slave can work with no right to the product of his effort. The doctrine that human rights are superior to property rights simply means that some human beings have the right to make property out of others. Since the competent have nothing to gain from the incompetent, it means the right of the incompetent to own their betters and to use them as productive cattle. Whoever regards this as human and right has no right to the title of human. The source of property rights is the law of causality. All property and all forms of wealth are produced by man's mind and labor. As you cannot have effects without causes, so you cannot have wealth without its source, without intelligence. You cannot force intelligence to work. Those who are able to think will not work under compulsion. Those who will won't produce much more than the price of the whip needed to keep them enslaved. You cannot obtain the products of a mind except on the owner's terms, by trade and by volitional consent. Any other policy of men toward man's property is the policy of criminals, no matter what their numbers. Criminals are savages who play at short range and starve when their prey runs out, just as you're starving today. You who believed that crime could be practical if your government decreed that robbery was legal and resistance to robbery illegal. The only proper purpose of a government is to protect man's rights, which means to protect him from physical violence. A proper government is only a policeman, acting as an agent of man's self-defense, and as such, may resort to force only against those who start the use of force. The only proper functions of a government are the police, to protect you from criminals, the army, to protect you from foreign invaders, and the courts, to protect your property and contracts from breach or fraud by others, to settle disputes by rational rules according to objective law. But a government that initiates the employment of force against men who had forced no one, the employment of armed compulsion against disarmed victims, is a nightmare, infernal machine designed to annihilate morality. Such a government reverses its only moral purpose and switches from the role of protector to the role of man's deadliest enemy, from the role of policeman to the role of a criminal vested with the right to the wielding of violence against victims deprived of the right of self-defense. Such a government substitutes for morality the following rule of social conduct: you may do whatever you please to your neighbor, provided your gang is bigger than his. Only a brute, a fool, or an evader can agree to exist on such terms, or agree to give his fellow men a blank check on his life and his mind, to accept the belief that others have the right to dispose of his person at their whim, that the will of the majority is omnipotent, that the physical force of muscles and numbers is a substitute for justice, reality, and truth. We, the men of the mind, we who are traders, not masters or slaves, do not deal in blank checks or grant them. We do not live or work with any form of the non-objective. So long as men, in the era of savagery, had no concept of objective reality and believed that physical nature was ruled by the whim of unknowable demons, no thought, no science, no production were possible. Only when men discovered that nature was a firm, predictable absolute were they able to rely on their knowledge, to choose their course, to plan their future, and slowly to rise from the cave. Now you have placed modern industry, with its immense complexity of scientific precision, back into the power of unknowable demons, the unpredictable power of the arbitrary whims of hidden, ugly little bureaucrats. A farmer will not invest the effort of one summer if he's unable to calculate his chances of a harvest. But you expect industrial giants, who plan in terms of decades, invest in terms of generations, and undertake 99-year contracts, to continue to function and produce, not knowing what random caprice in the skull of what random official will descend upon them at what moment to demolish the whole of their effort. Drifters and physical laborers live and plan by the range of a day. The better the mind, the longer the range. A man whose vision extends to the shanty might continue to build on your quicksands, to grab a fast profit and run. A man who envisions skyscrapers will not. Nor will he give 10 years of unswerving devotion to the task of inventing a new product, when he knows that gangs of entrenched mediocrity are juggling the laws against him, to tie him, restrict him, and force him to fail. But should he fight them and struggle and succeed, they will seize his rewards and his invention. Look past the range of the moment. You who cry that you fear to compete with men of superior intelligence, that their mind is a threat to your livelihood, that the strong leave no chance to the weak in a market of voluntary trade. What determines the material value of your work? Nothing but the productive effort of your mind, if you lived on a desert island. The less efficient the thinking of your brain, the less your physical labor would bring you. And you could spend your life on a single routine, collecting a precarious harvest or hunting with bow and arrows, unable to think any further. But when you live in a rational society, where men are free to trade, you receive an incalculable bonus. The material value of your work is determined not only by your effort, but by the effort of the best productive minds who exist in the world around you. When you work in a modern factory, you are paid not only for your labor, but for all the productive genius which has made that factory possible. For the work of the industrialist who built it. For the work of the investor who saved the money to risk on the untried and the new. For the work of the engineer who designed the machines of which you were pushing the levers. For the work of the inventor who created the product which you spend your time on making. For the work of the scientist who discovered the laws that went into the making of that product. For the work of the philosopher who taught men how to think and whom you spend your time denouncing. The machine, the frozen form of a living intelligence, is the power that expands the potential of your life by raising the productivity of your time. If you worked as a blacksmith in the mystics' Middle Ages, the whole of your earning capacity would consist of an iron bar produced by your hands in days and days of effort. How many tons of rail do you produce per day if you work for Hank Reardon? Would you dare to claim that the size of your paycheck was created solely by your physical labor, and that those rails were the product of your muscles? The standard of living of that blacksmith is all that your muscles are worth. The rest is a gift from Hank Reardon. Every man is free to rise as far as he's able or willing, but it's only the degree to which he thinks that determines the degree to which he'll rise. Physical labor as such can extend no further than the range of the moment. The man who does no more than physical labor consumes the material value equivalent of his own contribution to the process of production, and leaves no further value, neither for himself nor others. But the man who produces an idea in any field of rational endeavor, the man who discovers new knowledge, is the permanent benefactor of humanity. Material products can't be shared. They belong to some ultimate consumer. It is only the value of an idea that can be shared with unlimited numbers of men, making all sharers richer at no one's sacrifice or loss, raising the productive capacity of whatever labor they perform. It is the value of his own time that the strong of the intellect transfers to the weak, letting them work on the jobs he discovered, while devoting his time to further discoveries. This is mutual trade to mutual advantage. The interests of the mind are one, no matter what the degree of intelligence, among men who desire to work and don't seek or expect the unearned. In proportion to the mental energy he spent, the man who creates a new invention receives but a small percentage of his value in terms of material payment, no matter what fortune he makes, no matter what millions he earns. But the man who works as a janitor in the factory producing that invention receives an enormous payment in proportion to the mental effort that his job requires of him. And the same is true of all men between, on all levels of ambition and ability. The man at the top of the intellectual pyramid contributes the most to all those below him, but gets nothing except his material payment, receiving no intellectual bonus from others to add to the value of his time. The man at the bottom, who, left to himself, would starve in his hopeless ineptitude, contributes nothing to those above him, but receives the bonus of all of their brains. Such is the nature of the competition between the strong and the weak of the intellect. Such is the pattern of exploitation for which you have damned the strong. Such was the service we had given you, and were glad and willing to give. What did we ask in return? Nothing but freedom. We required that you leave us free to function, free to think and to work as we choose. Free to take our own risks and to bear our own losses. Free to earn our own profits and to make our own fortunes. Free to gamble on your rationality, to submit our products to your judgment for the purpose of a voluntary trade, to rely on the objective value of our work and on your mind's ability to see it. Free to count on your intelligence and honesty, and to deal with nothing but your mind. Such was the price we asked, which you chose to reject as too high. You decided to call it unfair that we, who had dragged you out of your hovels and provided you with modern apartments, with radios, movies, and cars, should own our palaces and yachts. You decided that you had a right to your wages, but we had no right to our profits. that you did not want us to deal with your mind, but to deal instead with your gun. Our answer to that was, may you be damned. Our answer came true. You are. You did not care to compete in terms of intelligence. You are now competing in terms of brutality. You did not care to allow rewards to be won by successful production. You are now running a race in which rewards are won by successful plunder. You called it selfish and cruel that men should trade value for value. You have now established an unselfish society where they trade extortion for extortion. Your system is a legal civil war, where men gang up on one another and struggle for possession of the law, which they use as a club over rivals, till another gang wrests it from their clutch and clubs them with it in their turn, all of them clamoring protestations of service to an unnamed public's unspecified good. You had said that you saw no difference between economic and political power, between the power of money and the power of guns. No difference between reward and punishment, no difference between purchase and plunder, no difference between pleasure and fear, no difference between life and death. You are learning the difference now. Some of you might plead the excuse of your ignorance, of a limited mind and a limited range, but the damned and the guiltiest among you are the men who had the capacity to know, yet chose to blank out reality. The men who were willing to sell their intelligence into cynical servitude to force. The contemptible breed of those mystics of science who profess a devotion to some sort of pure knowledge. The purity consisting of their claim that such knowledge has no practical purpose on this earth. Who reserve their logic for inanimate matter, but believe that the subject of dealing with men requires and deserves no rationality, who scorn money and sell their souls in exchange for a laboratory supplied by loot. And since there is no such thing as non-practical knowledge or any sort of disinterested action, since they scorn the use of their science for the purpose and profit of life, they deliver their science to the service of death. To the only practical purpose it can ever have for looters, to inventing weapons of coercion and destruction. They, the intellects who seek escape from moral values, they are the damned on this earth. Theirs is the guilt beyond forgiveness. Do you hear me, Dr. Robert Stadler? But it is not to him that I wish to speak. I am speaking to those among you who have retained some sovereign shred of their soul, unsold and unstamped, to the order of others. If in the chaos of the motives that have made you listen to the radio tonight, there was an honest, rational desire to learn what is wrong with the world, you are the man whom I wished to address. By the rules and terms of my code, one owes a rational statement to those whom it does concern, and who are making an effort to know. Those who are making an effort to fail to understand me are not a concern of mine. I am speaking to those who desire to live and to recapture the honor of their soul. Now that you know the truth about your world, stop supporting your own destroyers. The evil of the world is made possible by nothing but the sanction you give it. Withdraw your sanction. Withdraw your support. Do not try to live on your enemy's terms or to win at a game where they're setting the rules. Do not seek the favor of those who enslaved you. Do not beg for alms from those who have robbed you, be it subsidies, loans, or jobs. Do not join their team to recoup what they've taken by helping them rob your neighbors. One cannot hope to maintain one's life by accepting bribes to condone one's destruction. Do not struggle for profit, success, or security at the price of a lien on your right to exist. Such a lien is not to be paid off. The more you pay them, the more they will demand. The greater the values you seek or achieve, the more vulnerably helpless you become. Theirs is a system of white blackmail devised to bleed you, not by means of your sins, but by means of your love for existence. Do not attempt to rise on the looter's terms, or to climb a ladder while they're holding the ropes. Do not allow their hands to touch the only power that keeps them in power, your living ambition. Go on strike, in the manner I did. Use your mind and skill in private. Extend your knowledge, develop your ability, but do not share your achievements with others. Do not try to produce a fortune with a looter riding on your back. Stay on the lowest rung of their ladder. Earn no more than your barest survival. Do not make an extra penny to support the looter's state. Since you're captive, act as a captive. Do not help them pretend that you're free. Be the silent, incorruptible enemy they dread. When they force you, obey, but do not volunteer. Never volunteer a step in their direction, or a wish, or a plea, or a purpose. Do not help a hold-up man to claim that he acts as your friend and benefactor. Do not help your jailers to pretend that their jail is your natural state of existence. Do not help them to fake reality. That fake is the only dam holding off their secret terror, the terror of knowing they're unfit to exist. Remove it and let them drown. Your sanction is their only life belt. If you find a chance to vanish into some wilderness out of their reach, do so, but not to exist as a bandit or to create a gang competing with their racket. Build a productive life of your own with those who accept your moral code and are willing to struggle for a human existence. You have no chance to win on the morality of death or by the code of faith and force. Raise a standard to which the honest will repair, the standard of life and reason. Act as a rational being and aim at becoming a rallying point for all those who are starved for a voice of integrity. Act on your rational values, whether alone in the midst of your enemies or with a few of your chosen friends, or as the founder of a modest community on the frontier of mankind's rebirth. When the looter's state collapses, deprived of the best of its slaves, when it falls to a level of impotent chaos, like the mystic-ridden nations of the Orient, and dissolves into starving robber gangs fighting to rob one another, when the advocates of the morality of sacrifice perish with their final ideal, then, and on that day, we will return. We will open the gates of our city to those who deserve to enter, a city of smokestacks, pipelines, orchards, markets, and inviolate homes. We will act as the rallying center for such hidden outposts as you'll build, with the sign of the dollar as our symbol, the sign of free trade and free minds. We will move to reclaim this country once more from the impotent savages who never discovered its nature, its meaning, its splendor. Those who choose to join us will join us. Those who don't will not have the power to stop us. Hordes of savages have never been an obstacle to men who carried the banner of the mind. Then this country will once more become a sanctuary for a vanishing species, the rational being. The political system we will build is contained in a single moral premise. No man may obtain any values from others by resorting to physical force. Every man will stand or fall, live or die by his rational judgment. If he fails to use it and falls, he will be his only victim. If he fears that his judgment is inadequate, he will not be given a gun to improve it. If he chooses to correct his errors in time, he will have the unobstructed example of his betters for guidance in learning to think. But an end will be put to the infamy of paying with one life for the errors of another. In that world, you'll be able to rise in the morning with the spirit you had known in your childhood, that spirit of eagerness, adventure, and certainty which comes from dealing with a rational universe. No child is afraid of nature. It is your fear of men that will vanish, the fear that has stunted your soul, the fear you acquired in your early encounters with the incomprehensible, the unpredictable, the contradictory, the arbitrary, the hidden, the faked, the irrational in men. You will live in a world of responsible beings, who will be as consistent and reliable as facts. The guarantee of their character will be a system of existence where objective reality is the standard and the judge. Your virtues will be given protection, your vices and weaknesses will not. Every chance will be open to your good, none will be provided for your evil. What you'll receive from men will not be alms, or pity, or mercy, or forgiveness of sins, but a single value: justice. And when you'll look at men, or at yourself, you will feel not disgust, suspicion, and guilt, but a single constant: respect. Such is the future you are capable of winning. It requires a struggle. So does any human value. All life is a purposeful struggle, and your only choice is the choice of a goal. Do you wish to continue the battle of your present, or do you wish